Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yep.
Wait, do you want to do? We should run just a classic intro.
Sure.
Hey, I'm Jad.
And I'm Robert.
I gotta be honest, I have no idea what we're about to do.
This is,
Whoa. What's this? Are we on a boat?
No, but we're gonna be. This story actually starts in a supermarket.
Why so did now, you give me the boat? Well, as a tease?
Yes, that's a tease. That's what a classic tease.
So give me some supermarket then.
I'll give you some supermarket.
That's Pat Walters. See, I asked Pat a few weeks ago to...
Hi, Pat. By the way,
yes, Pat Walters, regular person here.
Pat is one of our producers.
I said I want him to look for stories about old lobsters.
Why?
Well, I'm not going to tell you that right now, but you'll see later on why.
Come on, give me a hint.
No, I'm not going to give you a hint. But he found a lady.
If you could just introduce yourself.
What do you want me to say?
Whatever you want to say.
Okay. Hi, I'm Bonnie Hazen. I'm a registered nurse, and
Bonnie told us a pretty crazy story.
To just tell you briefly. What happened was I had just gone to our grocery store.
Just any old day? It wasn't
just any old day. Nothing special about that day.
And where is this just...
In McMurray, where I live. Little McMurray, Pennsylvania. We're about 15 miles south of Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And,
The year, Jad,
yes.
is 1990.
August of 1990.
So I was looking around, you know, admiring the new seafood department, and I noticed this tank...
A lobster tank.
And there were only two lobsters in the tank.
One, she says, was really small. But the other one...
This huge behemoth that was just so massive.
How big is big in this case?
He was like from the tip of my finger to my elbow.
Oh.
That's big.
Yeah, so she sees this big lobster. And she's like, that tank is way too small.
She thought the lobster looked... cramped.
Yeah.
So she goes over to the guy behind the seafood counter and she's
somebody,
like,
well, what are you going to do with this big lobster? And he kind of just let me know that it was a promotional for the new seafood department.
Oh, like it was just this big lobster that would get sent around to different supermarkets when they wanted to attract attention.
And I just made a few more inquiries and worked my way up to the store manager, and he referred me to the vice president of the chain. And
Straight away.
Oh yeah, because you know, they couldn't answer my questions. I probably was a little bit of a pain.
Right.
Like, what are you going to do with them?
This is the moment where the manager of the store decides, okay, we have a complaining lady. I think I can solve the problem. He makes her an offer.
The bottom line was that I could have him if I could arrange for him to return to Maine.
She could have him if she could somehow get him back to Maine?
Mm-hmm.
To Maine.
I don't know why. I guess all lobsters are from Maine, he thought. So that's the offer.
Like, okay, how do I do that?
That's a good question.
Is this an unusual experience? I mean, this is one case.
This actually has a long history of people rescuing large lobsters.
That's Trevor Corson. He's the author of, what is it, The Secret Life of Lobsters?
Yeah, The Secret Life of Lobsters.
Some people may remember the story of Mary Tyler Moore.
No, I
haven't. In 1994, Mary Tyler Moore developed a crush on a large lobster, 12-pounder.
Who was named Mr. Grant?
Nope. No. He was named Spike.
Spike.
In Malibu, California, in a restaurant called Gladstone's, she put up $1,000 for the right to rescue him.
Wow.
$1,000. And then Rush Limbaugh heard about this. And he called the restaurant and offered $2,000 for the right to eat Spike.
Well, so what did the restaurant do then?
It refused. It still refused. And there's been other cases since then.
Trevor told us that he's actually read about dozens of these lobster rescue stories.
But our lobster story is the original lobster story.
The very first.
I don't want to make the claim forever for sure, but I'm just saying this, that if you Googled it, this is your opening lobster.
All right.
So it's still 1990.
Yeah.
Bonnie, having now left the supermarket, she's at home thinking now,
I didn't know what to do.
And she doesn't have the lobster yet.
She has no lobster yet.
That was when I started calling some of the local animal organizations, Animal Rescue League and the ASPCA, just locally trying to see if there was anybody out there that could help. And there really wasn't. They're more into mammals. Dogs,
they've probably never
cats.
Even heard of such
no,
a thing.
No, they basically told me, forget it.
So what, are we talking weeks of research here? Or
7 hours.
Really?
Oh, I was on the phone for hours.
A little obsessed.
But I had the time, and it was kind of fun.
So this has become a project for her.
Yeah, it's a project.
Yeah.
Okay. So then I called the Cousteau Society, because I was a member of the Cousteau Society, and they suggested I call our local newspaper.
Ah. The press.
The article appeared in the Saturday morning paper.
Oh, really?
But I have it right here. Cruisin' Crustacean.
Cruisin' like cruise, like cruise.
Yeah, not cruising, but cruisin'. C-R-U-I-S-I-N.
Okay.
Crustacean. McMurray woman talks supermarket into releasing large lobster. I really didn't talk about it. I'm just quoting now. Yes, it's a long story. It began Friday morning when Mrs. Hazen entered the Giant Eagle supermarket. There in the store's newly opened seafood section, she encountered Nick.
Nick?
Oh, the lobster has a name.
Nick.
Nick.
Nick, clearly the king of crustaceans, was lounging in a large circular saltwater tank along with several lesser lobsters. There was just the little one.
Yeah.
Something in the way Nick moved spoke to Mrs. Hazen, so she spoke to several Giant Eagle employees. Mrs. Hazen, who describes herself as environmentally active, told them she thought Nick might be happier back home in Maine than on someone's Corningware. I really didn't say that. Don't worry, Mrs. Hazen was told. Nick was a professional lobster, 70 years old.
70 years old?
Yeah.
Well, we don't actually know. There's no way to technically age a lobster perfectly. Estimates are from 50 to 100 years for those big suckers.
Wow.
I'm not an environmental crazy. I eat lobster, but I think they're over-harvested. Nick must be set free.
I didn't say that either.
I see you pounding your fist on the desk.
Nick must be set free.
They told me I could have Nick if I promised to take him to the ocean. Mrs. Hazen has no money for such a trip. Sounds like I'm destitute. Anyway, I guess that's what appeared then in the Saturday paper.
And that could have been the end of it. But
Saturday morning, we got an early phone call, and there was this woman on the other end of the line.
I'm Tony Leone.
And she was saying she was in town
for my dad's funeral.
And she was returning that afternoon to Maine.
No.
Yes.
To Maine?
Portland, Maine.
So I figured I'll just bring him back with me.
No, but why would you even think to do something like that?
Because he was a massive lobster in a teeny weeny tank that literally he could barely move in.
Now, there's one other thing. Remember, she was back in Pittsburgh for her dad's funeral.
So is this in any way an homage to your dad?
Oh, my God. He loved lobster. He absolutely loved to eat lobster.
To eat lobster?
Yeah, he would eat them like crazy.
But he also loved that his oldest daughter would do things that none of his other kids would ever do.
Yeah. He would know that I would do something like that. He would expect me to do something like that.
So anyway, Tony and Bonnie, they're on the phone.
And at first, Bonnie is actually a little suspicious.
I said, are you sure you're not just saying this to eat him? Because, I mean, you know.
And I said, no, I wouldn't eat anything this big. He's, you know, he's too old.
Oh, she reassured me, and she sounded very nice. So we agreed to meet at Giant Eagle. So of course, now I'm getting my daughter, my youngest daughter. Oh, we gotta hurry up. Hurry up, getting up and dressed. We gotta go to Giant Eagle.
And the woman met us at the store.
Because she had a 2 o'clock flight or something like that.
She was there with the manager. And
I didn't know there was gonna be a photographer there from a local TV station in Pittsburgh. Anyway, Tony bought the biggest styrofoam cooler she could find.
Which really still was a little too small for him.
He barely fit.
But we got him in there, taped it up as best we could.
Put him in a van, and away they went.
When we got to the airport, we get up to the reservation desk, handed him to the stewardess, and she put him in a chair in first class.
What kind of a... Wait a second. Wonderful.
We were in coach. This lobster's up in the first class.
So the plane then touches down in Portland, Maine, where the wildlife police are waiting.
Again.
Is anyone able to determine what everyone here seems to have assumed, that this lobster comes from Maine?
No. In fact, it probably wasn't caught here.
Why do you say that?
In Maine, you can't catch big lobsters like that. That's illegal.
Because the big lobsters are the ones that make more babies.
Oh.
They have size limits that they have on their lobsters.
So you are bringing a lobster then to a venue that you reasonably suspect is a foreign place.
It's a foreign country.
Wow.
But he can make friends.
So, the next morning,
the harbor patrol called and said, do you want to go with us? We're going to put him in the water. So we jumped on their boat.
And a newspaper reporter went out on the boat with them that morning, too.
Okay, so I mean, this is from Maine.
Bonnie read it to us.
Just after 1 p.m., as the Marine patrol boat locked in 30 feet of water, Tony Leone carefully dropped Nick over the side. She watched him sink in the choppy, fog-shrouded waters, and then grinned, I'm glad he made it. Isn't that nice?
It is nice. But here's the real deep question here. When we look at our fellow creatures, we decide, well, who do we want to protect? We include some groups and we exclude others. It seems almost entirely arbitrary. For example, why would someone save this lobster?
Yeah, I mean, a lobster is not cuddly by any stretch of the imagination. Certainly not soft.
I mean, was it its beauty? Well,
I actually think that that lobsters are very attractive.
Really?
did you always think that?
I have always thought, you know, a lobster is like it's how can I say this appropriately for radio? They're muscular and curvaceous at the same time. They're like Popeye arms, those claws. And then there's that nice curving tail. And I just think that lobsters
are... You have a hunky lobster calendar? Lobsters of 2008?
I'm not talking about that on the radio.
That's just weird. I mean, that can't be the reason why people keep saving lobsters.
No,
I don't.
So what is it?
I think that it has partly to do with our obsession with longevity.
Hmm.
When it's one that big and that old, suddenly the rules are changed. Here is a creature, you know, that has made it through all the tests of life, and it deserves our respect now.
He was unique. He was special, and I just felt that didn't deserve to be in that tank at his age.
Yeah.
Everything kind of converged at that moment. I that's the only way I can explain it is just kind of went with it.
Story about lobsters. Thank you, Pat.
I thought of dropping Pat into the ocean along with Nick, but when I had him upside down, I realized he was kind of attractive in his own right, and...
As if you could pick me up.
Okay, coming up, we move from the sea to dry land, where we're going to meet yet another animal. In this case, the animal has stolen not just the hearts, but frankly, the minds of an entire Caribbean nation, so... You should stay tuned for that.
Hey, Eliza here. It has been a while since I've read Sloan. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Hey, Lulu here. You asked, and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt, and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon / not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program. That is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you either way for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out. And thanks.
That lime doesn't cut it very much. Like, it's really powerful.
It's basically straight rum. Yeah. Oh, this is a very traditional Guadeloupean drink called tiponch.
As in punch?
As in punch.
Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
Today, we're going to go off to an island.
Yeah, a small little corner of the globe.
Which, in its very surprising way, is trying to figure out how to understand itself.
Buffet itself.
And protect itself.
Against the whims of the wider world.
Yeah, exactly.
Comes to us from our reporter, Simon Adler.
So, I went to Guadeloupe a couple weeks back, which is this French overseas department, basically a territory of France.
And where's Guadeloupe?
Guadeloupe is this series of islands in the Caribbean, bit east of Puerto Rico and 400 miles north of Venezuela, more or less. Okay, so just landed. The runway we landed on here was just bordered on both sides by these super lush green walls of flora. I have no idea what they were. And the story I want to tell actually starts on a watermelon farm. It's okay if I park here? Okay. Owned by this couple, Sully and Lois.
Thank you so much for being willing to do this.
They look to be in their late 40s.
Not a problem.
So how many...
Sully had on a pair of glasses, t-shirt, and cut-off blue jeans.
I'll just introduce you to my wife.
And Lois...
Bonjour, nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you, how are you?
...was wearing one of those floppy hats and big rubber boots.
Okay, good.
So, you were born here in Guadeloupe?
Yeah, I was born in Guadeloupe, yes.
In what part of Guadeloupe?
I was born in Pointe-à-Pitre.
So after growing up in Guadeloupe and graduating, Sully decided to get off the island for a bit, went overseas for work.
In Guyana, the ex-British Guyana.
Met Lois.
Oh.
And fell in love.
It's true.
Anyway.
Then I came back to Guadeloupe 20 years ago to establish myself in the farm area.
And did you buy this farm right here?
Actually, I didn't buy it. The land was in the family for a long time, okay? So I decided just to give them a hand, you know? And then we ended up staying, so, you know.
Oh, so it wasn't planned that you would be...
It wasn't planned at all. Not at all.
And eventually, they kind of fell in love with farming.
We enjoy it. So it's a new, different way of living, you know.
They've got like 60 acres of land, these rolling hills, bordered by the ocean, filled with their crops.
Tomatoes, sweet peppers, pumpkins, and watermelons. Watermelons are our main crop, yeah.
So Sully and Lois took me out to their actual farm.
So this is these are what we have to harvest still.
And there, in this field, I was surrounded by just hundreds and hundreds of these enormous watermelons. These are huge.
Yes, they weigh about 20 to 25 pounds.
And this was actually why I was there, because these watermelon in this field for the past 15 years have been under attack. This one is...
Yes.
Another one that was punctured and...
This one is fresh.
Oh, man. Okay, they've been here recently?
Yes, like last night. Still red, it's still fresh.
And there's this golf ball-sized hole bored into the side of it.
It has a diameter of maybe 2 inches.
And the watermelon itself had just been emptied out. It's incredible. It's like they...
A deflated ball. And you walk on and it's the same thing and the same thing and the same thing.
This field was just littered with hollow watermelon.
This is the worst attack we've had in about 3 years. As I said, they did it specially because you were coming.
And let me just ask this, because I think it's time. Who or what is doing all this?
Raccoons.
It's raccoons.
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 Of course, raccoons.
Yes, those masked bandits with those little tiny hands.
And the adorable sort of roundness.
No, not adorable at all.
I think think they're kind of cute.
No, they're so not cute. No, no, and no.
But even if you think they're horrible, you have to give them that they are clever.
Yeah.
They were sneaking into Sully and Lois's field at night, finding the biggest, ripest watermelon in the patch, boring a tiny hole into it, scraping out the juicy innards.
They just scoop it out.
And chowing down.
It's a fiesta.
And for Sully and Lois, this was a huge problem.
You're pissed off. Anyway, on a quarter of an acre, you're able to lose a third of it.
So a third of the watermelon crop would just be eaten?
Yes.
Meaning?
It could go up to 20% of your revenue. Yeah, sure.
Thousands of dollars.
So we couldn't stand these losses too much, you know. We had to do something. We had to fight.
So what do they do?
Well, so 15 years ago, Sully and Lois declare war.
Meaning what?
Well, to start with,
we put an electric fence around our field.
Zap them, keep them away.
Okay.
But pretty quick.
They know to put a branch and walk on the branch and get into your field anyway.
They built a sort of bridge.
What, you mean they would walk over the branches?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So then they've got to try something new. This time they're like,
we have to be there at night chasing them.
We'll blast music at them. We'll run around.
With lights, with sound, with music.
At one point, Sully even stooped to just throwing rocks at the raccoons.
He picked up a rock and he just, bam!
I'm a good pelter, but you can't stay in the field all night long.
So next thing they decide to try is, okay, let's put some traps out in the field.
We tried to trap some, but they're very smart.
These big metal sort of tripwire cages.
But one day, there was no trap. We found a trap in the woods, and it was all bent up.
Wait, they run away with the trap?
With the trap, yes.
The raccoons were actually destroying them.
Sometimes we just study them and see, oh, shucks.
So for their final attempt, they decided, okay.
We had to try the dogs.
Guard dogs, put guard dogs in the field. But
the next day when we came,
It was
it was a carnage. It was a massacre.
The raccoons killed one of your dogs.
Exactly. All of his intestines were outside, so it was a duel to the death.
Oh, yeah, really?
So, you know what kind of animal you're dealing with?
This confirms every feeling I have about raccoons. They are not just clever, they are fierce and immoral animals.
They're as good and bad in everyone, and these were obviously not very nice raccoons. And if I were in Lois and Sully's position, of course.
I would shoot these raccoons. Well, is that what they did?
Well, or poison them, something.
Well, yeah, I thought that if anybody would be on board with some sort of eradication campaign, it would be Sully and Lois, right. Yeah. But when I floated this idea by them, if I was you, I would want to kill those raccoons. They just kind of looked at me funny.
Killing them is a little harsh.
But they're attacking your livelihood.
Yes, yes.
I'm trying to understand how you...
I know it sounds strange, because I myself, putting myself in your position, I would find it strange too.
It's just maybe a sentimental feeling, you know?
Wait, why...
Sentimental feelings.
What does that mean?
Well, here's the thing. The people of Guadalupe, they acknowledge that these raccoons are super destructive. They know that they are attacking not only watermelon farms, but goat farms and chicken farms, that they're going and tipping over trash cans in downtown Pointe-à-Pitre. But yet, simultaneously, they adore them.
The raccoons are very lovely, so lovely.
Of course we love the raccoon.
Yeah.
They put them on their postcards.
We just think it's so cute.
Driving down their main highways, you see billboards where people's logos for their advertisements for their tire company is a raccoon. Like, it's everywhere. There is a statue of a raccoon. At the zoo with Bienvenue, Zoo de Guadeloupe, they're the number one exhibit. Here they are. The first thing you see when you walk in.
We have many in the trees there.
Oh, wow. Couple up there like monkeys. And on the way out of the zoo...
Can we follow you?
Yeah. Okay.
When you walk into the gift shop, got a coffee cup with a raccoon on it, a snow globe with a raccoon in it, keychains. Might have to get one of those.
People love the raccoon.
People are raccoon crazy on this island.
Why?
Well, it's really complicated. It has to do with the history of the island. It has to do with who came to the island when and who gets to say what happens on the island. It has to do with power, like who...
You're talking about a raccoon here? That's still...
Yeah, all of these problems and ideas are inside the raccoon's tail, in fact.
In its tail?
The tail of the raccoon and the tail about the raccoon, yeah.
What? You gotta unpack this for us.
Explain this a little better.
Well, the trouble all started...
Au début des années 1900,
in 1911,
with this guy Garrett Millett,
un scientifique qui a décrit,
he was a scientist working at the National Museum in D.C.
Au muséum en Amérique, quoi.
This, by the way, is Blandine Guimont.
La police de l'environnement.
She works for the wildlife police. Spoke to my interpreter Sally Stanier and I, and she told us one day Miller was just hanging out in his office when a box showed up from Guadeloupe. And he opened it up and found...
Raccoon mort.
A very much dead raccoon.
Yeah, a sort of misshapen skin and like an accompanying skull.
This is Christopher Helgen.
Curator of mammals at the National Museum of Natural History, part of the Smithsonian Institution.
Actually has the same job that Miller had back in 1911. Anyway, this raccoon that Miller had in front of him...
looked a lot like the North American raccoon, but it was small and different in quite subtle ways. And so...
After some inspection, Miller
baptized the Guadeloupean raccoon a distinct species.
Scientific name?
Procyon minor.
Procyon minor.
Le raccoon guadeloupéen.
The Guadeloupean raccoon.
Putting a name on it and recognizing it as a new species implied a deep history of the presence of raccoons in Guadeloupe.
Hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years. And over these millennia, these raccoons had evolved into their own distinct species.
Found nowhere else on the planet.
So is that... when the Guadeloupians began to love raccoons, when they realized they had their own, you know, one and only?
Yeah, but, it took a while to catch on. I mean, this discovery was initially only being talked about in these arcane academic scientific journals. It's not like this discovery was on the front page of the Guadeloupian Times or anything. In the 1980s, you know, conservation really came into its own. Scientists started worrying about species disappearing from the planet. And in particular, they started worrying about this raccoon.
These raccoons, you know, were being recognized as potentially endangered.
Thought and, being they're only on these islands, there probably aren't that many of them. Like, we've got to protect these things.
Oui, c'est ça.
And so,
elle date de 1989.
Since Guadeloupe is an overseas French department, France decided to do just that. February 17th, 1989.
Legislation was created to protect the raccoon.
And shortly after the passage of this law, Guadeloupe opened up its first national park.
And the raccoon became the mascot, the symbol of the national park.
And as the mascot of this new national park,
symbol des espèces protégées,
it really became that symbol of protected species
en Guadeloupe.
It was celebrated.
La population est là.
People were like, okay, nice, we love the raccoon.
And more than just a symbol of the importance of protecting the natural environment of Guadeloupe, over time the raccoon became, in a way, a symbol of Guadeloupe itself.
It's really that symbol for people. Like, you can definitely see it as the bald eagle in the U.S.
Aside from raccoons, you didn't really have hardly any other mammals that are native to these islands apart from bats. And so if the raccoon is the one furry critter running around that everyone can point to and say, this is something special, you know, this is not the same as a raccoon you'll find anywhere else. That is an exciting thing. It's a powerful thing and a point of pride, I think.
I mean, we're not late in this time zone.
Okay.
Come in.
Okay.
Bonjour.
Na, c'est Na, N-A.
Very good to meet you. How are you?
Vous savez, l'âge n'arrange pas les choses.
No, age doesn't help things.
This is Namarie Joseph. And you were born here in Guadeloupe?
Oui.
Yes, indeed.
She's an older woman, maybe in her 70s, wearing this pink floral dress. Her house was right on the highway with a field in the back. And that, she says, is where the raccoons would hang out.
There was a whole bunch of them just like chilling in the area because all this behind the house was sugar cane. They actually came and fed on the sugar cane. I loved seeing them. I mean, there was always some type of pleasure and excitement, like seeing those raccoons out there.
Ce petit-là.
And at some point, there was one that we really became acquainted with.
At that point, she scooched her chair over and picked up this black and white photo that was sitting on her dining room table and inspected it. Well, can I see the photo that you have here?
Est-ce que je peux revoir la photo que tu as ici?
Eh bien, je lui donne un bout de pain.
Basically, what's on the picture is Sophie, and I'm feeding her bread that I dip into milk.
Sophie was a pet raccoon that Na had back in the late 80s. And she talked about Sophie as if she were her child. You're making the gesture of like cradling a baby.
Sophie, viens me voir. Quand je sortais quelque part. Sophie, viens, Sophie, venez.
She would run around and like, every time I called her name and everything, like she would just like come running.
Il avait un petit biberon, hein, Sophie.
I was really close to him, and like when other people came to visit, they could see that I had this rare wild animal with me.
And at one point, she got really quiet.
Dis Sophie.
And grasped the photo very tightly.
Sophie.
You're holding it to your heart.
When he died, I cried. I cried his name. It was a really, really painful time for me. It's important sometimes to have something of your own.
I almost got the sense that having this raccoon as its national animal was a way for Guadeloupe to distinguish itself from France.
What do you mean?
Well, so Guadeloupe has always been pushing against France trying to declare some sort of cultural or national independence. In fact, just a couple years before this this law was passed,
a group called the Guadeloupe Liberation Army claimed
this group that was fighting for independence from France blew up a section of Guadeloupe's airport, studio in the government-owned TV station, even a Chanel fashion perfume store in central Paris.
The explosion tore out windows and doors and left racks of high-fashion clothing in shreds.
And it felt to me like in some small way, the raccoon had become a way for the Guadeloupeans to say to France, this is ours, not yours. And because of that, it also became a point of tension between France and Guadeloupe.
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
Well, the morning after I met up with Na, I went to this police station.
Bonjour. Oh, good to see you.
To talk to these police officers.
Do you mind saying your name for me?
Oui, alors David Rosé.
David.
Groslo. Anthony.
Anthony.
Jean-Simon Ramdine.
Simone.
Au service mixte police de l'environnement de Guadeloupe.
As well as a couple others. All of them but one were white and French. They were stationed here in Guadeloupe. And they took us up into this sort of war room, which was the second story of this bungalow-type building out in the middle of the jungle.
Donc là, on va faire un briefing sur l'opération distincte.
Everybody was sitting around this makeshift boardroom table, and pretty quick after the meeting started, they booted up this PowerPoint.
So I've got a PowerPoint up with a picture of a raccoon displayed up against the wall here.
This image of a raccoon crouched down in this chicken wire cage.
Wait, so what is going on here?
Well, they're planning a raid to liberate this raccoon. In fact, they had the location where it was being held mapped out with entry points designated. They even had the license plate number of the man believed to be holding the raccoon.
And why exactly are they doing this?
Well, because as Anthony Groyot, the leader of this whole operation, explained to me, the law passed in France back in 1989 declaring the raccoon as a protected species. It specifically outlawed killing raccoons, transporting raccoons, and even
pour l'agrément, pour le plaisir.
Having raccoons for pleasure. You can't raise a raccoon as your own pet.
L'enfant de la famille.
Sometimes we're taking away a child of the family, literally.
Faire appliquer des lois, tout simplement.
But in France, the law says they can't be held as pets.
Alors, en tant que policier.
And as a police officer, and here I'm speaking as a police officer, I have to be here to enforce the law, period. no questions asked.
And so, once the briefing was over, they headed outside, strapped their pistols to their belts, threw the rest of their gear in the back of these SUVs, and took off.
Everyone is rolling out. We're in three vehicles.
And 20 minutes later, we arrive at the top of this hill, peering down into this lush, dense jungle.
We're walking down this driveway into the forest.
We get halfway down the hill, and...
Wait, what?
Someone here?
Yeah, apparently someone is here.
In this clearing, we spot this man. He doesn't see us.
There's a guy in a red shirt with a camouflage hat on. He's got his hand behind his back.
The cops tell us it's too dangerous. You guys can't go any further.
Ah, cool.
And so Sally and I duck behind some trees. And then Simone and Anthony, wearing a wireless microphone, rush into the clearing to confront him.
Bonjour, monsieur. C'est la police de l'environnement?
Okay.
Anthony started grilling him a bit.
Vous connaissez la réglementation?
Oui, oui, je connais ça, mais bon.
Asked him if he knew about the law. Said he did.
C'est quoi? Qu'est-ce qu'a dit la réglementation?
Bon, il faut protéger.
Oui.
Protéger, mais comme.
And even though I was like 30 yards away, I could see that the guy just seemed confused.
Je le vois pas au clair.
D'accord.
And pretty harmless.
We're all good here. He's cooperating.
Right away.
Closer, maybe?
Please.
Okay. He told them where the raccoon was.
Oh, there he is.
In this chicken wire cage behind this giant tree.
Cute little guy.
This rough-looking raccoon. They pull out a toolbox, wire cutters.
Raccoon is grabbing the wire cutter.
Like it thought it was playtime or dinner time. They cut open the cage, reached into it with these thick leather gloves. And then they grabbed it by the neck and threw it into this kind of dog carrier box thing. And
oui, mission accomplie.
The mission is a success.
It went as swimmingly as, you know, you could get.
I gotta say, this whole thing sounds a little, I don't know.
A little much for this? For just releasing a pet?
Yeah, no, agreed. But
we're gonna go on foot, basically.
Okay. Later that morning, we went on this second raid.
What are we expecting from this scenario?
And the seriousness clicked into place for me.
It's really a different setting.
We walked into this courtyard surrounded by maybe 10 houses, many of them made of sheet metal.
And do we know where the raccoon is supposed to be?
It's right there under those trees.
He pointed at this pile of trash surrounding this enormous white cage, and there inside was this golden-looking raccoon.
There's houses all around, so we need to see who is really in charge of this raccoon.
But before the officers could do anything to free it, a crowd started to gather.
No, pas de problème.
Okay, a woman has just arrived.
She's asking basically what's going on.
Three or four people showed up, heads started poking out of windows. And Sally overheard one of them saying
that someone snitched and said that there was a raccoon in the area.
She said someone snitched.
Yes.
And I suddenly realized that all of the officers were very on edge.
So we're just going to live.
Why can't we just take the raccoon?
Just for safety reasons. They don't want to, you know, stay here too long.
And we got out of there. So tell me what was going on in that second situation, because a lot of it was over my head.
It's really understanding the context, the setting. I mean, this is not just the police. I mean, it's white police forces coming into an overwhelmingly black and poor neighborhood that has a lot of, you know, significance in this context.
Ils m'ont emmené aussi, hein? Ah ouais.
In fact, when I was talking to Na about this the night before, she said that if police officers had ever come to try to take Sophie,
I mean, they would have had to take me in as well.
I would have
taken my husband's gun and I would have, you know, I would have shot.
When we come back from break, the tale thickens.
Yeah. We'll be right back.
This is Timothy Franzik calling from Stillwater, Minnesota. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krolwich.
This is Radiolab, and we're back with reporter Simon Adler, who's telling us the story of the Guadeloupean raccoon, which, as we just heard, for the people of Guadeloupe, is both a point of pride and a point of tension.
We are in the back rooms here.
We are beyond the public areas, exactly.
And to understand what happens next,
we're going up to the sixth floor of the museum.
We have to go to the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History here in the U.S. with mammalogist Christopher Helger.
Where we are now is what's called the Type Collection, the world's largest library, essentially, of dead mammals.
I have to say, for such a grand place, it's a little visually underwhelming.
Basically just a bunch of locked white cabinets.
But that said, it's the behind-the-scenes area where, you know, the real treasures are stored.
Can we take a quick detour so I can explain what he means by that?
Sure.
Okay, so scientists, taxonomists, their job is to name and differentiate species, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do they do that? Well, let's talk about sharks, because sharks are kind of cool animals, right? Mm-hmm. Imagine there's this shark species, it's swimming around, it's having a great time. And at some point, half of the sharks in this shark population decide to leave, to go somewhere else. I don't know, they go to deeper waters or to a different ocean. They get cut off from their previous shark family. They don't see them for a long time. And over thousands or maybe a million years, they actually start evolving on their own as sort of a new type of shark.
So they become different enough that they've become a new species.
That's what the scientists come in and try to figure out.
Now, how do they make that determination?
Basically, it's a comparison game. They compare them to the old sharks. Do they look the same? Are their dorsal fins taller or shorter? They'll look at how they behave in the water, how they move through the world. Is that different? Nowadays, they'll even just do genetic work. And if they decide it is a new species of shark, at that point, they do this sort of wacky thing that I had no idea about. Once they've decided that this shark is a new species, scientists will go and kill one of these sharks. They will stuff it, put it in a box, and then they will store it in a locked cabinet in a natural history museum somewhere.
Because ever after, for hundreds of years, that specimen becomes kind of a gold standard, the definition of that species. There's a different key for types than others. We just every kind of moth or mite or mollusk or mammal, you know, every oak tree, every kind of zebra, somewhere in the world, there is a museum cabinet where locked down there is a physical specimen of that organism.
That's exactly. So it's like, it literally is like the natural museum histories of the world are like the library, the
card catalog of
life.
Yeah. Huh. And the room that that Helgen took me into in the sixth floor of the Smithsonian, it was just cabinet after cabinet after cabinet after cabinet filled with these type specimens, including
the Guadeloupe raccoon type specimen.
The very specimen Miller inspected back in 1911.
So here we go.
Helgen bent down and opened this one particular cabinet.
I'm pulling out a big metal drawer.
And inside?
Well, here it is.
This is it right here.
Here it is, right in front of you.
This sort of ratty-looking taxidermied raccoon.
It's maybe not the most pretty sight. You know, the ears are a little bit broken and bitten off.
Some of the stuffing was coming out of the belly.
But that's probably how it arrived.
Now, Helgen first saw this raccoon back in 2000. And one of the first things he did was
turned it over and looked at it, and it's small.
Maybe like 18 inches long.
Something like that.
Just like Miller had reported. But then he popped open this little white box that had the skull in it.
And take a look. What do you see here?
He pointed at these fine white lines crisscrossing the dome.
These are open sutures, which show that the skull is still growing.
In other words,
it's not an adult.
Which to Helgen was a big deal. Because ever since being a kid, he was suspicious of the Guadalupean raccoon.
It didn't add up to me. I just had a suspicion of, you know, these Caribbean raccoons didn't make sense.
He said, if you look at islands, they usually don't have just one native mammal species walking around. This made Guadalupe an outlier. And so
I'm going to put it on this tray.
The fact that this thing was a kid meant that there was nothing special, at least, about its size.
And, you know, by the time I laid my hands on this one and looked at the skin and skull, I'd seen so many raccoons in museum collections that, you know, I knew their skulls and teeth really well. And so when I saw this, you know, one of the first things I noticed is that there was just nothing that looked any different to me from the common raccoon, the North American raccoon.
And so Helgen decided to do some genetic work. He compared the DNA of these Guadalupean raccoons against North American ones.
Did the math, we made the comparisons, and a clear answer came through. Not only are these, you know, not very different, they are just simply North American raccoons.
You mean Guadalupean raccoons are the same ones that come in and torment my garbage cans?
The exact same raccoon.
The, you know, common, literally garden variety raccoon that we have in our own backyard.
Now, for scientists and conservationists,
it is a real turnabout, you know. It goes from being distinct, special, endemic, you know, found nowhere else, to just the opposite. An invasive species.
So when Helgen started publishing papers on the raccoon in 2002, conservationists were excited.
Because raccoons, they can have real impacts. They will do things like eat sea turtles, birds' nests, bird eggs, including of some that are potentially endangered. They'll eat the...
Wait, so they were hurting actual endangered species?
Yeah.
And so now that they have proof, now that they are certain that this raccoon doesn't belong here, then they feel finally we're going to be able to go out and start doing something about this. Protect the actually special ones, get rid of this one sort of faker.
Oh.
But... putting conservation aside, what you've got is this native to the island national icon animal that has suddenly become
an interloper brought there within the last, you know, 200 years.
Probably just on a boat.
Huh. Well, given everything that you've told us about the colonial history, how did the Guadalupeans react to this?
Well,
we went down in 2004.
Helgen and his mentor.
To Guadalupe. And we talked to some people associated with the zoo and with the government management of the park. And it was just a very brief conversation.
He made sure that they had heard the news.
You know, guys, this raccoon that's found only in your country, it's not what you thought it was, and it doesn't belong here. And I remember that the message that came back to us was essentially, thank you very much, but we're gonna hold on to our raccoon.
Y a pas réellement de communication importante.
Meaning, according to Blandine Guimont,
there was no major communication campaign held on to make sure that the population knew that there was a change in status.
The government never really told anyone. And when someone did say something,
mais aussi,
like Gérard Berry here,
oui, bien, je m'appelle, Gérard Berry.
He's a native Guadeloupean, longtime conservationist.
Les premiers écrits, mais je défendais le raccoon comme tout le monde.
You know, a few years back, I was interviewed by a reporter and I told him what I knew for a fact.
Et on avait voulu me couper la tête.
And everyone was just saying, you know, off with his head. Some of my friends were like,
comment tu peux dire des choses comme ça?
How could you possibly say this? You know, you should not have said this. This is bad.
And so for over a decade now, nothing has changed. The laws haven't been amended. And because the government's kept this so hush-hush, many people on these islands still don't know the truth. Well, so my understanding of the story is for many, many years, there was this thought that... In fact, I accidentally broke the news to Na. Very recently, it was discovered that, no, in fact, it's the same species that lives in the United States. Does that change your feelings about Sophie or about the Guadalupean raccoon in general?
Moi, je croyais que c'était en Guadeloupe seulement qu'il y avait. Hein.
Mais est-ce que ça change du coup le... C'est vrai, la même espèce.
Ah bon. Aux États-Unis, il y en a.
You can find it in the United States? But wait, so is it possible that maybe it was brought to the United States?
The scientists say that it was brought here from the United States.
Moi, je croyais que c'était en Guadeloupe seulement qu'il y avait.
I mean, I always thought that the raccoon was really endemic to Guadeloupe.
C'est notre bête à nous, Guadeloupéen entier.
It is kind of sad for me to know that it's not endemic to Guadeloupe. I mean,
non.
I wish it would have been so. To be honest.
And then I had the even less enviable task of informing Na that just this past July,
invasive exoten,
the EU passed this regulation.
We recognize that we cannot act on all the thousands.
Basically, a blacklist of invasive species
whose negative impacts concern the European Union.
The thing is, particularly in Germany, the raccoon is terribly invasive. These raccoons have actually been called Nazi raccoons as they spread from Germany throughout the continent. And so the raccoon made the list. And that means that member states like France, and thus very likely overseas agencies like Guadeloupe, will have to start managing or even eradicating them. From the folks I've spoken with, there's a good possibility that in the next year, the raccoon is going to change from being a protected species to being a species that can be hunted, trapped, and killed.
Ce qui veut dire qu'il pourrait être une espèce qu'on peut chasser, qu'on peut attaquer.
Non, 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 il faut pas, hein. Faut protéger la bête, hein. Mais ça me fait mal déjà à savoir ça.
It kills me.
Ça me fait mal.
It kills me the thought that, you know, people could start hunting raccoons. Like, we have to protect them.
Ah, non, 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 non. Ah, non, oh là là. Ah, Sophie.
It's not a specific species? Yeah, okay, got it. I just don't care.
Angelique Charlette, owner of the Guadeloupe Zoo. Wait, you don't care?
No, I don't care. It's just the raccoon of Guadeloupe.
But it's kind of an imposter, isn't it? It kind of tricked everyone, didn't it?
He's not responsible of the person saying it was another species. People make an error. He didn't do anything.
You must respect the animal, you know.
Even Sully and Lois, the watermelon farmers from the beginning of this story, said at the end of the day,
if, let's say, they say, okay, as of this date, the raccoons are no longer whatever. I don't see myself taking a rifle, running to the field, and just lying in wait to shoot them, no.
It's just that we have a few type of wildlife, you know, no snake, nothing. So, you know, is the bigger one, the biggest one. So people adopted it as a national animal. That's it.
It's one of those, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with type situations.
Could be.
That's a good one.
So, as a pragmatic person, I know it's an invasive species today. I know it. But I know also, I think he's cute. And I think I like it. So, what is the best balance to find? You see? I don't know.
Kind of interesting that we in America love the bald eagle, a kind of wretched bird that steals other people's nests and is generally a vulgar animal, actually. But we never think of it that way because we've given it majesty and we give it, you know, in its talons there you see both, you know, peace and war. It has been, we have dressed it up.
It has been given America.
And I think every time a nation chooses to identify with some wild thing, it's mostly really about the people identifying, not about the animal.
Yeah, I totally agree. But I see it like this, like there's, like you have this fact, right? There is a fact here that the raccoons didn't show up a million years ago or whatever.
Right.
It was probably more like 200 years. That's most probably a fact.
Yeah.
But then there's the stuff on top of that, which is like, Are they natural? Are they invasive? Do they belong here? Those don't feel like facts. Those feel like judgments. And like, who gets to make those judgments? The scientist? I don't know.
I certainly didn't realize the extent that this was a deep-seated cultural battle in which I was, you know, entering.
You have inserted yourself, yes, strongly.
Again, Christopher Helgen.
It's just the same information, you know, different responses. And
well, and I think that one of the deep questions of that, of this story, lives in that, which is, like, you came to a scientific truth. And the question becomes, should that scientific truth win the day?
I mean, as a scientist, you know, I would say yes. You know, as a conservation biologist, I would say yes, that's important. It shows us that taxonomy really matters. This animal didn't belong. And, you know, really perhaps it should be removed from the island. But at the same time, it's really a question for Guadeloupe. You know, this is their island. These are their animals running around on it. And it can be very challenging for scientists like myself to come to terms with. But that's how the world works.
One more thought before we go. Is okay. That all right?
Yeah.
Before Helgen officially sank or dethroned this Guadeloupean raccoon, there's actually another guy with a similar hunch. This Parisian mammalogist named J.M. Pons. And in one of his papers, he wrote that even if it can be proven that the Guadeloupean raccoon is no different from the North American raccoon, that the best answer might not be its reclassification or eradication, but instead, its isolation. He wrote that its, quote, insular distribution prevents gene exchange with the mainland and is likely to warrant different selective pressures that should favor short-term genetic differentiation that may lead to a long-term speciation process.
Wait, what does that mean?
Meaning, if they were able to keep these North American raccoons on Guadeloupe isolated long enough, maybe someday they could be reclassified yet again, this time as real Guadeloupean raccoons.
What's your response to that?
I forgot that Pons said that, you know, I like it, but I have to say, you're going to be waiting a long time.
That's going to take a while.
We want to give super, super thanks to Sally Stagnier, who was our translator and got Simon everywhere he needed to go and made sure that it all worked out. And to Ali Pinnell here in New York, who helped us make sense of the whole thing before we left. So we owe her a huge debt.
Thanks also to Hervé Magnon, David Xavier Albert, Lawrence Baptiste Salomon, and Florian Kirshner.
And to Bernie Bilmion.
And most especially, thanks to Simon Adler, who reported and produced the whole story.
Yeah.
I want to read you guys this one paragraph real quick. Can we, before we go, sign off?
About what?
Because you know how we were arguing about whether the raccoon is a good creature or an immoral creature? Mm-hmm. And I was looking for ammunition on the internet to find to read to you guys.
Oh, that would
and
be
I found this thing. I found this thing. It's in a blog called The Truth About Raccoons.
Oh, boy.
And it's it contains this paragraph, which I'm pretty sure is not true. It goes, and I quote, "Raccoons are one of the only land mammals who can also walk on the bottom of riverbeds, holding their breath for up to an hour."
What?
"They eat both live prey and carrion and consume up to 20 pounds of raw meat at a time, then go without food for a week. Their skeletal structure is found in no other animal, and that, combined with their ferocity and complete lack of moral fiber, make them perhaps our most dangerous enemy." I rest my case.
That was no case. That was just propaganda. That was hate speech.
Message 1.
Hi, my name is Sally Stagnier. I'm Guadeloupe interpreter.
So I'm reading the staff credits right now. Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad. Dylan Keith is our director of sound design. Lauren Wheeler is senior editor. Jamie York is our senior producer. Our staff includes Simon Adler, Rena Farrell, David Jebel, Matt Kielke, Robert Krulwich, Annie McEwen, Lakis Nasser, Melissa O'Donnell, Arian Wack, and Molly Webster. With help from Tracy Hunt, Valentina Bohanini, Nigar Fatali, Stevie Wang, and Katie Ferguson. Our fact checker is Michelle Harris. All right, that's it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
End of message.